Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, March 19th. Right now, the race between vaccines and variants continues, as we all know. While we're learning about how the virus works and how to protect ourselves against it, it is also learning, in its way, about how we work and how to protect itself from our efforts to avoid it. Dr. Daniel Griffin has been on the front lines of the pandemic with his patients and advising other doctors as an infectious disease clinician and as a researcher at Columbia and chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the ProHealth Medical Group. Dr. Griffin, thank you for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Brian.
And so has your role been primarily to treat patients once they're sick enough with COVID to be in the hospital?
Brian, I think that's hopefully what I can bring to this. I always refer to myself as a physician scientist, physician first, and I've been taking care of, hundreds and hundreds of COVID patients, but the whole spectrum, Brian, from the outpatient setting all the way into the hospital, into the ICU, and then out the other side.
So I'm curious what you're seeing in your practice, and in particular, what you see and what you hear from other doctors at ProHealth when it comes to hospitalization and ICUs. Are we winning this war?
Right now we're sort of in a holding game, I think. We're sitting here on this plateau, and we say it's the virus against the vaccines. And as we're ramping up our vaccines, we're doing everything we can, unfortunately, to help the virus with the opening up. Some of us think a little bit too quickly. But we're sitting at this holding pattern, and people can look at the numbers nationally and in the New York area. We see it and hear it. We're sitting with about 4,000 to 5,000 people in the hospital, and we've been there for about a month now. We're seeing between 50 and 100 people die every day, and that's been what's been going on for the last month. So, as the vaccines ramp up, the virus is getting an opportunity to change, and we're having challenges how that impacts some of our therapies. So there's every reason to be optimistic, but we're still in the middle of this pandemic. We still have across the country over 1,000 people dying a day. And we are not where I wish we were at this point.
Long haulers, you were in the news recently because you noticed that some of your patients experiencing COVID's long tail have gotten relief following vaccination, which we usually think of as to prevent COVID-19. Tell us what you're seeing.
Yeah, this is a shocking new paradigm, right? Vaccines as therapeutics as opposed to vaccines just for prevention. I was a little dismayed and continue to be dismayed April, May, when I started noticing this ritual of clapping patients out of the hospital with the idea that now they were all better. But then I've continued to take care of those patients for months and months. And now I think people are becoming more aware that for a significant chunk of individuals, COVID is not just 2 weeks, they suffer. And so back in December, when we first started vaccinating healthcare workers first, a lot of them with long COVID that I care for, we were really pleasantly shocked to see that about 30-40% felt significantly improved. And that seems to be holding. Some of them, it takes that second shot, but this is really encouraging. A virus that has always thrown surprises our way, almost all of them terrible. This is the first time I have to say this is a really pleasant and positive thing that we're observing.
And you know what? We have a caller right away on the phones who seems to be having that particular experience. Chris in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Oh, thanks, Brian. Sorry about the technical troubles this morning. I used to do live audio engineering, so I felt all of your pain. But I really, I was waiting, and I was so hopeful that you got the phones working because this is huge for me. Doctor, I just wanted to tell you that I'm one of those people. I worked in grocery services for the last year. March 19th is my anniversary when I first started to show a temperature. And I stayed sick for 3 weeks, and I got better, and I thought everything was going to be great. And after that, I learned to live on kombucha and HCL tablets because my digestive system just didn't want to do anything anymore. And I would get ridiculous muscle cramps out of nowhere that would lay me up in bed for days. And I was brain fogged. I was paranoid. I felt unlike myself. I hadn't been myself for a year. I got the Johnson & Johnson virus a few weeks back. I don't remember the date. I really should. Vaccine, yes. I got sick for 4 days. I felt like I was going to be the first person to die from the vaccine. And then I'm happy. I'm better. I feel 75-80% of what I was before I got sick. And that is beyond amazing. I can't speak the praises about getting the vaccine enough for people who may have long-term effects.
Dr. Griffin, do you want to ask Chris anything as a patient or just a caller?
Well, I think first, thank you, Chris. This is, I think, the way medicine is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a dialogue. We're supposed to learn as much from our patients as we can teach them. And, early on, Chris, we saw this with the RNA vaccines, and, we didn't know it's J&J going to work as well. And actually, I mean, this is great. Here you are giving a firsthand account. It looks like all the vaccines are providing this improvement. Now, I don't want to oversell it, Chris, because unfortunately, as you probably know, there's about half the folks that are still suffering. But my gosh, 30-40% feeling better like this. This is tremendous. And Chris, I guess I'll ask you, early on, we were a little worried about the vaccines. We're going to, set people back. Were they going to get a vaccine and then lose whatever improvement? Did you have that fear going into this, or were you going in with that positive, hopeful attitude?
Well, positive and hopeful and really, 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 really well-researched. So I'll tell you what my theory was. Maybe you can tell me if I'm having fun or just maybe I'm onto something. I had thought that somehow because of the exposure in the grocery store environment where we were under maximum exposure, I mean, the numbers of people that got sick in my store alone are just staggering. But I did the research and I was keeping up with as much discussion groups as I could. So I wasn't really paranoid, but I was super hopeful because what it felt like is the digestive and, neuromuscular and really my brain fog sounded like a virus in hiding, almost like a herpes virus. And it was evading the immune system. And when I would get stressed out or paranoid or overworked too much, I had only been working 1 or 2 days. It was my maximum amount of physical activity I could endure. I was thinking it acted like a cold sore. It would pop up and lay me out for days at a time. So I was super hopeful that the vaccine would give my immune system a boost against variants or other mutations that were hiding and go out and seek and destroy.
What do you think, Dr. Griffin? Has he nailed the mechanism, or does he have a good theory there?
We're going to name it after you, Chris, the Chris mechanism. Actually, you are right on. We have two main theories. And I think it is we. It's a lot of us talking and putting our heads together. I was reading an article by Akiko, fantastic researcher up at Yale. And at the very end, I was waiting for them to mention they had quoted me because it was exactly what I was thinking. And it was her words. We think a really prevalent theory is that the virus is not fully cleared. Either the virus is still replicating at a low level, or there's just remnants that are still provoking our immune system, making us still feel sick. And the leading theory is you give this vaccine, and particularly now that we're seeing with the J&J and the other vaccines that don't really give such a huge jolt, that maybe now we're finally clearing this out of our system. So, no, Chris, you are right on with the leading theory. We're still trying to sort this out. There's a lot of research underway to understand this. But that's right up there.
Chris, I'm glad you're feeling better. I'm really glad you called in. And maybe we'll have the Chris theory, and it'll be Chris and the Chris theory when they figure out exactly why the vaccines help the long haulers. Thank you so, so much. Let's do one more because this is a whole new category. We haven't heard these stories before, at least on this show, and we have at least one more coming in. So Vicki in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Vicki.
Good morning. I'm going to echo Chris. I had what they called mild symptoms in January of last year. It put me in the ER. I mean, mild symptoms, I didn't have to be intubated, but I was sick for 8 hours with a lot of different nausea and disorientation and dizziness. And after I got the vaccine, the Pfizer on March 10th, I have felt better in this last just over a week than I did in all of 2020. I would have fatigue. I would have muscle ache. I would have slight colds, like coughs, sore throat, swollen glands. Fatigue that came out of nowhere that I would have to have a nap for 2-3 hours at a time. So I'm going to just echo what he said. I feel great, and I feel grateful.
Can I ask you, Vicki, if that started after your first Pfizer shot or only after the second?
It started after my first because my second won't be until the 31st of this
month.
Oh, wow.
So even the first shot did that. Dr. Griffin, talk to Vicki briefly.
No, this is great, Vicki. You know, I take care of a lot of patients with long COVID. So when we were sort of having these shared decision-making sessions back in December, we were worried, are people going to get better or worse? And we saw a chunk of people just like you, Vicki, who they got their first shot, and it was really either a few days or a week or two when they started feeling better. Some people are feeling better after the second shot, and some people who feel, we'll say, 70-80% with the first shot, they get that extra with the second shot. So this is excellent. I was going to say, Vicki, you're in Brooklyn, right? So isn't it pronounced Pfizer?
Well, I'm in Manhattan, so we say Pfizer, but I'll go with Pfizer because I love all the New York accents. Okay. But it's a huge difference. I mean, my COVID fog is gone. You know, I can't tell you, I feel better than I felt in the last whole year.
Oh,
thank you so much. Well, more anecdotal evidence that this is really happening. And by the way, I get you were doing your Fauci there, right? Pfizer.
Yes, yes, yes. Your Fauci, ouchie. Your Pfizer.
We have just a few more minutes left with Dr. Daniel Griffin from Columbia and ProHealth. I want to touch at least one last thing before we run out of time. I know you do weekly updates on the podcast, This Week in Virology. This Week in Virology has such a good reputation, I should say, to our general audience. It's like, I think of This Week in Virology is to COVID as C-SPAN is to government. So... You got to be pretty wonky, you know, like to watch a whole Senate hearing or House hearing on C-SPAN. And same thing, if you want to, as a layperson, listen to the conversations about the virus at that level. But This Week in Virology is amazing in that way. And last week, you mentioned your concern about COVID-19 in children. So give us a quick update on what you think is new there.
Yeah, what I think is new there, again, is probably the long COVID angle here. You know, we look at statistics, and even Brian, when you started asking about, you know, COVID in the hospital, and I've had a lot of conversations where people look at, you know, what's the percent of people that end up in the hospital, what's the percent of people that die. But for most individuals, COVID is an outpatient disease. So when we look at kids and we say, okay, they're at low risk of ending up in the hospital, they're at low risk of dying, boy, half of them don't even have much in the way of symptoms. What we're seeing more and more of, large studies, great data out of the UK, great in the sense of robust, but not great in the sense of positive, that kids can develop long COVID as well. So we're starting to see more and more of that on the ground here. Kids who either didn't even have a strong case or maybe it was a mild case of COVID, now a couple months later, struggling in school, unable to play sports with their friends. So as we're looking at getting the kids back in school, I think the message we're realizing is kids may be at low risk, but they're certainly not at no risk.
Just one follow-up on that. Because we've been wondering on our team if there's more disease in children now, really, or just more testing of children. For example, Nassau County Executive Laura Curran suggested this week that one reason their positive test results are staying the same, that is, that plateau that you were talking about before, there's a, you know, consistent too high positivity rate in Nassau County, but hospitalization rates are dropping. And the county executive thinks maybe the reason or a reason is that they recently started routinely testing student athletes. Plausible?
It's definitely plausible. I mean, Brian, we're definitely seeing a shift in the positives from the older population, right? We've now done a great job of vaccinating our seniors in long-term care facilities. We've done a great job of getting people over the age of 65 vaccinated. But with that feeling of complacency, shall I say, the kids are getting more exposures. So I think it's a combination. Not only are we testing them more, but they're actually getting more infections. And I relate this to a conversation I had with Jay Berger, the head of our pediatric group at ProHealth New York. And when he does, when he's the sick doc, so to speak, and they see those acute visits, we're every time seeing multiple kids coming in with acute COVID symptoms. So it's not just a testing phenomenon. That's part of the numbers. But we're also seeing more symptomatic infections in kids as well.
You know, we just saw some COVID-19 breaking news, and we were talking about kids, so it's relevant, so I'm going to throw it at you. The CDC just revised their guidance for how socially distanced kids have to be in class from 6 feet to 3 feet. We knew this might be coming, and now it's come. Do you support it?
I actually do, Brian Lehrer. I'm going to a little bit of granularity here. I tweeted about this morning because I knew this was coming. You know, there was a recent study, and I'm going to say it was not a great study. I talk about it on Twim on Saturday. But there was a good study back in June. There's been a lot of studies looking at this. When you get individuals about 3 feet apart, about a meter apart, you get about an 80% reduction in the risk of transmission. You go to 2 meters or 6 feet, you drop it to 90%, right? So you get that most bang in that first 3 feet, in that first meter. You throw masks, get about an 80% drop there. So when you start putting this all together, you get the desks 3 feet apart, you get the kids wearing masks, you improve those ventilation systems and open the windows, you, dare I say, add testing to sort of reduce the chance of infectious kids in the schools. I think this is all going to work together to hopefully get our kids back in school. So, you know, the moms particularly can get back in the workplace. I think women have suffered disproportionately during this because of the impact on our kids, and our kids have suffered. So, no, I think that we can do this safely, and I think the CDC is updating the guidance based upon the science.
And we will emphasize the part of it that you said in the middle there, which is this is assuming that everybody is still wearing masks. And from the NPR write-up of this story, just breaking, the new guidelines still call for 6 feet of distance between adults and students, as well as in common areas such as auditoriums, and when masks are off, such as while eating, and the 6-foot distancing rule still applies for the general public in settings such as grocery stores. So can you explain that? We'll extend for one more question, because that's going to confuse people. Why 6 feet of distance between adults and students, or 6 feet of distance between students in common areas of the school, assuming they're all wearing masks, but not in the classroom? Do you get it?
I do, and it's okay. You know, I mean, I think we were always told to, like, you know, dumb down our message, but I don't think we have to do that anymore. I think the American public can be brought up, and I think we have for the first time, us science nerds, people want to listen, right? People are willing to take the time, and that's really what it is. We're balancing things. There are harms to keeping kids home. It's really difficult for most schools to open up if we demand 6 feet separation among the desks. You can keep adults 6 feet apart at the grocery store and these other venues. So we're really balancing risks here. So if the kids are 3 feet apart, they're wearing masks, we focus on hand hygiene, we focus on ventilation, you can do that safely. But in other situations, if you've got the 6 feet, let's go from an 80% reduction to a 90% reduction. So I think this is reasonable. The schools will have their 3 feet. We'll be able to do this, I think, very safely. But as much as we can, if we've got the space, let's use it.
All right, listeners, if you want to geek out on science, you can hear Dr. Griffin and his colleagues on TWIV. He called it TWIV there a minute ago, which stands for This Week in Virology. That podcast, and he is a researcher and an infectious disease clinician at Columbia and chief of the Division of Infectious Disease at the ProHealth Medical Group. Thank you so much. This has been so informative. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Brian, for all you do, and everyone be safe and follow the science.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.